Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Copenhagen.
And I'm Colm O'Mungain, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
This week, the Brexit reckoning. Boris Johnson, flushed from the love-in of the Tory party conference, finally sends his plans to replace the backstop to Brussels, but so far they've received a cool reception. We'll hear from RTE's London correspondent, Sean Whelan, who was in Manchester at the Tory party conference, on how the plan evolved.
And we'll assess what the proposals will mean. Two borders, four-year cycles of Stormont consent, millions of customs declarations.
What are the chances that the plan, roundly rejected by nearly everyone on the island of Ireland, with the exception of the DUP, will succeed? And what happens if it doesn't?
But first, Sean, Boris Johnson's first Tory party conference as leader. How did he perform?
He performed like Boris Johnson at a Conservative Party conference, except this year, and like previous years, he is the leader of the Conservative Party, and so he got to do the big leader speech at the end.
We will, under no circumstances, have checks at or near the border in Northern Ireland. We will respect the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. And by a process of renewable democratic consent by the Executive and the Assembly of Northern Ireland, we will go further and protect the existing regulatory arrangements for farmers and businesses on both sides of the border. And at the same time, we will allow the UK, whole and entire, to withdraw from the EU with control over our own trade policy from the start.
Now, veteran observers of the scene at these conferences over the past three and a bit years of Brexit tell me that the temperature here was considerably lower than last year's conference, and that the fringe events in particular were less visceral. I think that is the word, visceral, that the pro-Brexit party feel a bit more relaxed. I mean, these things are relative, but a bit more relaxed because their man is now in power in number 10, whereas last year he wasn't, and they didn't like what was going on with the incumbent in Downing Street. And so there was quite a lot of shouting and ranting going on last year. This year, they're a bit more relaxed.
And the mood in the conference, you vox popped a number of people at it. Were people optimistic of a deal or just happy enough with going no deal?
I get the impression that what they want more than anything is a general election. I don't think that Brexit was playing too heavily on their minds, to be honest. I mean, you know, yes, they want Britain out. They've bought into the line. We're out by the 31st of October. But whether it's with a deal or a no deal, there didn't seem to be that much strong sentiment in either direction. Really, what they wanted was a general election. You can feel it in the air. The Conservative Party in particular want to get stuck into Jeremy Corbyn. And also at the Labour Party conference the previous week, a similar sort of mood in the air. They want to get stuck into the Conservatives. So they seem to be more focused on a general election than Brexit itself.
Not much by way of the big reveal at the conference itself. That was to come later. So, Tony, if I could go to you, what was the mood music like in Brussels in terms of the Tory party conference? People tend to take what's said at a conference less seriously than they would other utterances, but at the same time they take it as indicative of an approach. How did it go down in Brussels?
Well, first of all, the Tory party conference was seen as a very important milestone because, as you know, and as we've discussed on the podcast, everyone has been waiting for Boris Johnson to bring forward the big text, his big plan to replace the backstop and bring it in legally clear and defined terms. And it was quite clear in Brussels, talking to different member states and EU officials, that no one really expected Boris Johnson to do that before he made his Tory party speech, because they didn't want him to be having to get into the weeds of, you know, papers that were sent to Brussels, and it was also felt that he couldn't make any big concessions ahead of the Conservative Party conference. So there was a certain amount of expectation around Manchester this week, and of course his timing was very precise. I mean, he gave the speech to the assembled faithful in Manchester, and then only about an hour or so later, David Frost, his chief negotiator, was in Brussels to hand over the paper to members of the European Commission task force, and then to start the technical talks and to get the ball rolling. But of course, there was quite a bit of churn this week before Wednesday. I mean, just to remind people, Boris Johnson came to power as leader of the Tory party promising to tear up the backstop, replace it with something else, eyeball the EU into doing a deal. If the Europeans weren't interested, then Britain would be out, do or die, come what may, at the end of October. And of course, we've had a huge amount of pushback from the House of Commons. We have the Benn Act, which basically legally obliges Boris Johnson to have an extension if he doesn't get that deal this month. So there's been an awful lot happening, and it's been a fairly torrid atmosphere. But through the briefings we've had so far, and through the technical meetings that David Frost has had in Brussels, it's clear that Boris Johnson has retreated big time from the promises of Theresa May to the all-island economy, North-South cooperation, the peace process, no hard border, no infrastructure, and so on. And he has been clearly going for something that is a lot more minimalist, and which seemed a few weeks ago just to envisage an all-Ireland agri-food regime, but with customs definitely, Northern Ireland definitely remaining in the UK customs sphere, so that there would have to be some customs border, some differential between Northern Ireland and the South, and that was really the direction of travel. Now, on Monday, RTE broke the story that one of the so-called non-papers that David Frost had brought to Brussels contained proposals envisaging what were called inland customs clearance sites. Now, that is, by any other name, that is a customs post, and these would be reflective of the fact that there would have to be customs checks, there would have to be tariffs, there would have to be declarations that would happen and would be applied no matter who you were, big or small trader. This was going to be the new reality on the island of Ireland, and this this leak that RTE got caused quite a stir, because it spelled out in quite graphic terms what the UK had been bringing to the table in Brussels, even if it wasn't exactly what Boris Johnson was going to propose when the legal text finally landed this week on Wednesday.
Sean, it's only as good any proposal by Boris Johnson, and to some degree there has been references to it in some quarters of the UK media as the Johnson deal. It's not a deal till it's a deal, and it's only as good as his ability and Europe's view of his ability to get it through Parliament. Has Boris Johnson succeeded in any way in putting back together the pieces of the Tory party that was so broken up after he initially arrived as Prime Minister and started trying to drive his proposals through, and summarily sacked over 20 MPs out of the Tory party for not going along with his wishes?
I think he has, and it's an interesting point you fasten on there. Speaking to one or two of those Tory rebels at the conference, they were inclined there to give Mr. Johnson a chance for his deal to go through. I mean, coming into this conference last weekend, there had been lots of talk about confidence motions, about trying to disrupt the Conservative conference by putting down a whole lot of parliamentary business, forcing MPs and ministers to race back from Manchester down to London to do a bit of parliamentary work early in the week. week and about making amendments to the Ben Burt Act to make sure that there are no loopholes that a couple of lawyers have identified in what are fairly extreme circumstances, it would appear. There might be a loophole in there. But Dominic Grieve in particular said, look, I think the Ben Act is fine. I think it's all weather, to use a phrase from backstop land. It should work in all the circumstances. And that Boris Johnson ought to be given the time to try and see if he can get a deal out of Brussels. So that group of Tory MPs, that group of 21, maybe 22, they seem to be in a holding pattern there and might well row in behind him. Certainly that is the line that's being suggested by people like Sir Graham Brady, who you may recall was the only person who's ever had a majority, a Brexit-related majority on any issue actually getting through in the House of Commons. He thinks there's a majority there, that the DUP are on side, and certainly after Tuesday night it was very clear that they were on side with the proposals that were going to be made on Wednesday. And then they are pinning their hopes on getting a few people from the Labour side, MPs who are in Leave constituencies and who themselves are pretty much convinced that they ought to be leaving the European Union. So there's been some talk, speculation in the 20 to 27 range majority that could line up behind the new Boris Johnson proposal. But the first thing is to unite the Conservative Party. So people like this group of the so-called Spartans, a small group within the European Research Group, led by Marc Francois, or he'd be a leading figure in it now, he was speaking at an event with Arlene Foster on Tuesday and saying, look, if the deal actually gets us out of the EU on the 31st, then I will be the first one into the I lobby. But if it doesn't get us out by the 31st, I will oppose it and no amount of browbeating will make me change my mind. Cue raucous applause from the crowd at this Bruges fringe meeting at the Conservative Party conference. Arlene Foster, who followed him onto the stage, was saying, I may disappoint some people in this crowd, but I actually want a deal and Northern Ireland badly needs a deal. So I'm very much in favour of having a deal. And that was a consistent line that she was saying to anybody who'd listened around the Conservative Party conference at a number of speaking engagements, which I'd followed her around to.
And news in today, if you're listening on Friday, news in today that Rory Stewart won't be coming back into the fold. In fact, he's resigned from the Conservative Party today. So not entirely a paradise of cooperation in Boris Johnson's Conservative Party.
Now, and Rory Stewart has been talking, or friends of Rory Stewart certainly have been talking about forming a new political party in recent days. So perhaps no surprise there. Some people have been taunting him at the conference. Come on, Rory, put up or shut up. Let's get on with it and see what happens. But others within that group of Tory rebels are very much giving the Prime Minister space and might well row in behind him. Because of this issue, which a lot of people spoke about at the conference, which was we must honour the result of the referendum and that there is 52% of the electorate who voted in that referendum do want to leave the European Union. So you can't really let that group down in the view of people who take that view. And they say even if we lost the referendum, we should still honour the will of the electorate.
Tony, the difference between Boris Johnson's proposed Northern Ireland protocol and the withdrawal agreement as agreed under Theresa May but not ratified by the Parliament in Westminster, what are the key differences and how are those differences viewed in Brussels?
Okay, so, I mean, it's probably a good idea just to remind people that Theresa May did actually sign up intellectually and maybe not emotionally, but certainly intellectually to the original backstop idea or the idea that an insurance policy for the island of Ireland was needed. So it had to protect things like the North-South cooperation. It had to protect the all-Ireland economy. It had to protect the single market. It wasn't just about avoiding having bits of infrastructure along the border. But Boris Johnson has taken a conceptually, fundamentally different approach. He thinks that all that's needed is that you avoid having infrastructure at the border. And that's why he's quite comfortable with the idea of Northern Ireland remaining in the customs sphere of the UK and the UK customs territory, and that there would be a customs border as a result. Now, just coming into the paper being delivered, one big step that he has taken, which has been welcomed in Brussels and in Dublin, is that he is prepared to have full alignment north and south along EU single market rules for industrial goods as well as for agri-food. A few weeks ago, we were convinced that he was only prepared to have agri-food rules and food safety and animal health rules and so on.
So goods only,
aligned,
not
north and south.
Services not mentioned.
Services were never mentioned because services don't really create a border, although they would interfere with the all-island economy. But services have never been a prominent issue in this, although it is an important thing which we should come back to at some point. But he was now accepting that there would have to be alignment on industrial goods and agri-food products north and south. So that would mean that you would have regulatory checks and controls on goods and agri-food products going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. And the counterbalance from Boris Johnson's point of view for that would be that Stormont would have to give its consent before going into this new backstop idea authored by Boris Johnson, and they would have to give their consent every 4 years after that. Now, in terms of the customs part of this, clearly the original backstop didn't foresee any customs checks because Northern Ireland would still be in the customs union according to the original backstop. But now under this plan, you would have to have controls and checks. Now, Boris Johnson saying that these can all be managed. They can all be simplified. There can be facilitations, exemptions. You can use technology. But all of that stuff would have to be worked out after the withdrawal agreement was signed in the transition period, which, according to him, would end at the end of 2021, 14 months' time, and wouldn't be legally operable in the meantime. It would be dealt with by the joint committee, which is formed by ministers and officials from the UK and the EU. That's already envisaged in the withdrawal agreement, but it wouldn't be legally operable in the meantime. Now, the whole question of physical checks and infrastructure is a really sensitive one, and it's really quite intriguing how it's unfolding. The non-paper that RTE broke on Monday night talked about inland customs clearance sites. Now, Downing Street flatly denied those reports, and yet the explanatory note which accompanied the legal text talked about custom checks happening on business premises or on other designated locations. Now, what is a designated location? One suspects that that is, again, a customs post by another name. So that's really the gist of what he's proposed. But of course, you know, there are a lot of things in there which are very problematic for the EU and Ireland.
Sean, it's a radical jump away from the point of view of Ireland. Number one, it's a different customs regime. Number two, it means customs checks. And as Tony says, some form of infrastructure in order to conduct those customs checks. Number three, there's a time limit. And number four, it seems to be trying to involve Stormont, the current status of which is unsure. All of those things throw into question the idea of a comprehensive insurance policy that will apply unless and until. What's your analysis of how likely this is going to provide grounds for movement, or how this is going to be just seen as more meat into the blame game?
Well, in some ways, this proposal looks like a classic Brussels, if I don't want to use the word fudge, but a classic Brussels deal or pitch for a deal. When you get a difficult situation, quite often the inclination is to pitch it into the medium term future for settlement then, to buy yourself a bit of time in the interim to do some other things or allow the main elements of a deal to bed down in the expectation that what is controversial now may be less controversial in 4, 5, 6 years' time. One example of that was in the Lisbon Treaty referendum in Ireland, where there was the promise of a protocol that would enable every country to keep a commissioner for a 5-year period, which would then be reviewable once again in the future. In fact, I think it's up for renewal now. the exact number of commissioners, but that was, or seemed to be enough to enable the Irish to have a second referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. So you could see the element there of pushing it into the future. Also, there's been so much talk over the past 3 years about how Stormont's absence has been very damaging in the whole Brexit talks process. And so there's a great emphasis by the two governments to try and get Stormont working again. And you get elements of a grand bargain here of linking a return of Stormont to the Brexit issue. So those elements are starting to roll, as it were, in this deal. The problems, as Tony has pointed to, come down to customs, and that's always been the case. The customs issue is very difficult. The two-border idea is extremely difficult. First of all, the internal island of Ireland customs checks. Well, if there's a no-deal situation, that's a reality that's going to be confronting the Irish government anyway. If they voluntarily sign up to it, it's probably more problematic for them. There's a view here in Britain, and particularly in the Conservative Party, that the North-South trade is so small that it's really not worth risking the whole deal for. Now, in strict economic terms, they're right. The North-South trade is very small. In fact, it's smaller than most economic models would predict it would be for neighbouring jurisdictions.
But the volume of East-West trade and trade from the north that goes through Dublin in the East-West direction is another factor in there too, isn't it?
It is, but remember, the Dublin port have spent 10 million, maybe more, building a new customs facility in the port precisely to deal with the east-west trade flows. So all of that stuff is going to be... There is a customs border on the Irish Sea. The problem is it stops north of Dundalk, and so that bit of sea in the Antrim coast and down coast, that is unchecked. So now the extension of the Irish Sea border up from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland forms a part of this Boris Johnson proposal. So you would see some kind of checking going on there on goods that are going into Northern Ireland, but I think not on goods going out of Northern Ireland to Britain. So again, it's really problematic and difficult to see how it's operational. But again, there's this view in the Conservative Party, or sections of it, influential sections, it should be said, that because the financial value of the trade between North and South is so small, that really you should just bully this one through. If we can use the rugby parlance now, we're in the middle of the World Cup, but just maul it over the line and get it sorted, and then worry about the details afterwards. You can fix things after the ball has been put down, as it were.
Tony,
they want to get this done quickly, and they think that's the weakest link, and just bully it in and sort it out later, because they think the issues are not really big enough in financial terms. But of course, financially, that may be so. Politically, they are enormous issues.
The role of the Assembly and the stance of the DUP, Tony, how is that viewed in Brussels?
Yeah, I mean, that's come up almost immediately in some of the reaction, which I was somewhat surprised about. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of concern about the customs border on the island of Ireland, given that the EU is sticking by its commitment to protecting the all-Ireland economy. And clearly, if you have a customs border that falls in the middle of that economy, then that breaches that objective. But in the hours after the paper landed from London, you had extensive briefing going on. You had Michel Barnier briefing the European Parliament's Brexit steering group. You had a senior official from Jean-Claude Juncker's cabinet briefing the working party, that's Brexit coordinators from member states. And then, of course, you had Michel Barnier briefing EU ambassadors the next day on Thursday. All of the briefing said that while there were welcome moves by Boris Johnson on the regulatory front, goods and agri-food, there were real problems with customs, the fact that it wasn't legally operable, but also people felt that this Stormont idea was an upfront unilateral veto that was going to be offered essentially to the DUP. And you know, this is something that the Europeans just simply find really problematic, because, you know, it first of all, it It seems to give the DUP a veto before this whole thing would come into effect, before the end of the transition. But also every 4 years you would have this sword of Damocles of legal uncertainty hanging over the Northern Ireland and Ireland economies. Now, interestingly enough, it was the Daily Telegraph which broke a lot of the details of the story of the Boris Johnson plan on Wednesday morning, and it talked about the so-called Stormont Lock. Now, Irish officials had been briefed the day before by Eddie Lister, who was who's Boris Johnson's chief strategic advisor, on the details of the UK text, but. When they saw Peter Foster's reporting of it the next day, it seemed that the briefing that they got from Eddie Lister seemed to fall short of an outright veto by the DUP. But what then appeared the next day seemed to be something that pushed it back towards giving the DUP something of a veto on this coming into effect, and then every 4 years that veto applying. So that's something that, that Dublin is a bit concerned about, and obviously we'll have to see now, you know, how this is going to go down. But, I mean, essentially, you know, if you're in the EU's regulatory sphere, if you're essentially in the EU's single market for goods and agri-food, I mean, no other part of Europe, neither national nor regional, gets to veto the rules every 4 years. And that's something that the EU is really going to resist.
Sean, as far as the view of the Boris Johnson Northern Ireland Ireland Protocol goes, in the UK, is it seen as final status, take it or leave it? That's part of its presentation, but is it really a starting point for a negotiation? And Tony, is it viewed as a sincere effort to get something across the line from the Brussels point of view, or a credible delaying tactic in order to shift the blame to Europe if it's rejected? Sean, you first.
Well, obviously it depends on who you talk to. In the middle of the week, it was all, you know, this is the final, first and final offer, take it or leave it. We're leaving on the 31st regardless. But, you know, behind the scenes, it seems a little bit of rowing back over the past 24, 36 hours on that rhetoric, certainly in private, that, yeah, we can talk, we can deal on this. And obviously a deal is something that two parties agree to, as you pointed out right at the start of this podcast. You know, the two sides have to talk on this thing, and it does have to be a negotiating stance. That's, again, what I was saying earlier, that this has the elements of classic Brussels fixing. But, you know, in a lot of these Brussels fixes, there is a point at which you come back and sort out the fix later on. But with an international treaty like this, and the fact that Britain will be no longer sitting at the EU table, well, that's a different type of arrangement. It's a different type of a deal, fundamentally different type of a deal. Just also, I mean, Tony was talking about the Daily Telegraph and its reporting on this during the week. Got a copy of it, today's paper, Friday's paper, sitting in front of me here. They've summarised it very nicely, their cartoonist Matt, with two cows talking to each other, explaining the Boris Johnson Irish protocol. And one says, "It's simple, our milk is Irish, and every 4 years the DUP decides whether or not our sirloin steaks should be British." So that's pithily summed up there by Matt of the Telegraph. I should also say, though, that the Telegraph, the whole centre of page one is a huge photograph of the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar. And given the week that's in it, that's probably not a good thing. They're talking about remaining in the EU is what Britain wants, says Varadkar down the side. And the whole front of the Daily Express says, "Anger, anger, as Irish PM says Britain wants to stay in the EU." This is what a couple of the papers are stoking up based on that meeting, or remarks following the meeting with the Swedish Prime Minister in Stockholm yesterday. And Tony, you were there at that meeting. What on earth did you say to the Taoiseach that made him stoke up anger amongst the headline writers of the Daily Express?
Well, this is the thing. It's an easy trap to fall into these days, and you have to kind of watch your P's and Q's, obviously. But yeah, I mean, that's why I'm in Copenhagen at the moment, is because the Taoiseach is he's in meeting the Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen. They've just done a cycle ride around the centre of Copenhagen, which apparently is obligatory for all foreign prime ministers. But yes, he was meeting the Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven yesterday, and at the news conference afterwards, you know, he was asked, like, you know, what are the obstacles to a deal?
I think there are two major obstacles. The first is the proposals on customs. You know, I don't fully understand how we could have Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in separate customs unions and somehow avoid there being tariffs, checks and customs posts on trade between North and South. So we need to tease that through. And then secondly, I think the issue of consent and democracy is important. And as I said before, any consent mechanism, any democracy mechanism must reflect the views of the majority of people in Ireland and Northern Ireland. And no one party, not my party, not Sinn Féin, not the DUP, should be in a position to veto what will be the will of the majority in Northern Ireland, our Ireland. So I think there is certainly a difficulty around that aspect of it.
And in his answer to that question, he said, well, you know, there are five ways to avoid a border returning on the island of Ireland. One is a united Ireland. He said that's, you know, no majority for that at the moment, although some opinion polls might suggest otherwise. Ireland joining the UK, never going to happen. Britain returning to the EU, and he said opinion polls have suggested that that's what most British people want. But the political system in the UK doesn't permit that. You know, obviously the fourth would be the backstop, then the fifth would be, you know, Ireland leaving the EU. And he said, you know, that's not going to happen either. So that was the context in which he said this. But that was, as you say, that was picked up by British papers in fairly outraged tones.
Tony, Michel Barnier, you said he was engaged in a round of briefings. I suppose he has been... despite the fact that he was portrayed in the past as being some kind of a hardliner, he's actually been one of the people who has tried to do business and was involved in the kinder face of Europe as far as Theresa May was concerned. So allowing for the fact that he's capable of taking a benign view of constructive proposals, do we know what he said to ambassadors? Do we know what he said to other EU institutions in terms of his opinion on the latest proposals emanating from London?
Yes, I mean, the basic message from Michel Barnier to the member states, and then in turn he was getting feedback from the member states, that's how that process works, was that the UK moves on regulatory alignment were welcome. Also, what hasn't really been picked up was that the UK had accepted the role of the European Court of Justice in monitoring and adjudicating on any single market disputes that might come up in Northern Ireland. But generally speaking, the lack of legal certainty, the lack of legal operability around the customs ideas and the Stormont lock, the so-called veto in Stormont, these were things that he said were very problematic. Now, the public utterances of the key players in this, Michel Barnier and Jean-Claude Juncker and the Taoiseach as well, have been very, very carefully calibrated, because everyone is aware that there is a bit of a blame game trap just around the corner. So they did not want to rubbish it completely. But by contrast, the European Parliament's Brexit Steering Group issued a statement on Thursday afternoon saying they had grave concerns with the British paper. And also there was a thinly veiled warning that the European Parliament wouldn't ratify this text because the Parliament has voted through resolutions on the All-Ireland economy and the backstop and protecting North-South cooperation and the peace process. So the Parliament is saying, you know, don't forget about us. We have to give our say in this as well. And on the basis of what the UK have put forward, we will not be doing that.
That's quite significant about the ECJ, isn't it? As you say, not much coverage on that, but that was a very much a red line issue heretofore in the hard Brexit quarter.
Well, it was in terms of the entire UK, and you know, you've had people like David Davis and Steve Baker coming out, you know, very prominent Brexiteers, saying it's not just the backstop. You know, even if you did pull out the backstop, you know, we would still want you know, any references to the ECJ to be expunged from a new withdrawal agreement. But here we are now with the UK accepting that in Northern Ireland, you know, you will have to have ECJ oversight if the single market is at play in Northern Ireland.
Okay, Tony, what from your end of it is coming up over the coming week? You're in Copenhagen at the moment, so what's going on there and what's coming up in the next few days?
Well, as I say, Leo Varadkar is here now. He's meeting the Danish Prime Minister as we speak. He's due to give a news conference in about half an hour's time, so there may be more developments there. But I mean, the ball is really in the hands of the European Commission at the moment. The task force have said that they are going to keep talking to the UK. David Frost is in Brussels today for talks again, and the feeling is that if it's clear that Boris Johnson is prepared to shift further on this, despite the take-it-or-leave-it rhetoric that was coming out of number 10 in the earlier part of the week, then they think it is worth pursuing. But I think we can't understate the real reservations that Brussels and Dublin have on the customs issue and on the Stormont veto or Stormont lock. But again, you know, the Commission are going to keep talking to see if Johnson can be nudged further towards the EU position. And on that basis, then you might start to see more intensive negotiations with the prospect of getting a deal by the October European Council. But I would say that still looks like a fairly unlikely gambit as far as I could see.
Sean, any set pieces to watch in your neck of the woods over the coming days?
Yeah, they're going to shut down the Parliament again. There's another prorogation programmed in for next Tuesday. This one seems to be by consent, and it will be totally legal because it's only going to affect three working parliamentary days. But apparently they need to close it down on Tuesday because the folks in the House of Lords have to install a couple of thrones so that the Queen and Prince Philip can come along the following Monday and have a formal state opening of the Parliament and a Queen's speech where Boris Johnson's government set out their legislative plans for the coming parliamentary session. Of course,
also known as the manifesto for the next general election.
Very much so. And that general election might come very, very quickly. People are talking about when was the last time a government lost a vote on a Queen's speech. Apparently it was sometime in the early 1920s. And the way things are going now, well, anything's possible, really, isn't it? Obviously, the real politics next week are going to happen away from the Parliament. It's going to be watching to see what signals are being sent from Brussels back to London, and we can expect a lot of activity on the telephones by Boris Johnson.
All right, that's it for another edition of Brexit Republic. From me, Colm O'Mungoin, RTE's Deputy Foreign Editor in Dublin.
And thanks from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe Editor in Copenhagen.
And from me, Sean Whelan, RTE's London Correspondent in, well, London.
Thanks for listening.